What you do see is the flame, the eternal flame from the crematorium chimney, day and night the fire. Always the awareness that people are burning there, people like yourself, with a brain and a heart that pumps their blood, that miraculous liquid, through an endless network of blood vessels, alive in all their fibers, in their most insignificant cells, God's miraculous creation. Sometimes the weather is damp and smoke hangs over the camp, that smell of scorched meat, of steak being fried in a pan that hasn't been greased properly. That's your breakfast, because you don't have any bread left anyway. At times like that, you can't bear it anymore. You're tired, sick, and disgusted by yourself, because you are a man, and the SS2 are men. After 5 weeks, the letter. I've tracked you down. A man who delivers wood to your camp's kitchen has found you. I'll speak to the Lagerarzt. Stick it out a little longer. It took another week before the block clerk came to get him. Hans was checked out at the administrative building and sent back to Auschwitz. Block 9 had undergone a great change. There was a new Blockältester. The previous week, the Lagerarzt had come to select the Musselmen. When the trucks arrived a day later to pick up the unlucky men, one was missing. An Italian Jew. Enormous tumult. In the evening, the man came back of his own accord. He had turned out with the building yard commando and spent the whole day lugging bags of cement. When the job was finished, the foreman had even praised him for his application. He had only wanted to prove that he wasn't a Musulman, that he was still able to work hard. The Lagerarzt, who came back the next day, wasn't receptive to that logic. He had the man taken away immediately and then called in Paul. His letting something like that happen in his block was a scandal. He'd given the Jew a thorough beating, at least, he hoped. But Paul was obstinate and, since falling in love with a Jewish girl, had developed a deep empathy for the Jews in the camp. I don't beat sick people. Then the Lagerarzt began bellowing that, in the end, communist riffraff always showed their true colors. They were Jew lovers, scum, filthy red swine. The grand physician punched Paul right in the face, twice, three times, until blood was pouring from his lips. Half an hour later, there was a new Blockältester. It was Zlobinski, a Pole, the former doorkeeper of Block 21. He had a reputation for being sly and coarse. He was difficult, inspected beds, screamed if there was a single straw on the floor, and harried everyone to work as hard as they possibly could. But after a couple of weeks, he fell in love with a girl from Block 10. From then on, he spent the whole day sitting at the window, and the Pfleger could doze off again and let the room orderlies, recovering patients, do all of the work. The day after his return, Hans went next door to Block 10 with the kettle commando to see Friedel. They were so happy his adventure had turned out well. How did you pull it off? He asked. I just went to Klein, the Lagerarzt, explained what had happened and that you were my husband, and then he wrote down your number. It's incomprehensible. That's the same dog who kicked out Paul last week after first holding a selection. At the start of the month, he was in Birkenau and cleared out the entire Czech family lager in 2 days. 1,000 men were put on work transport. 5,500 went up the chimney, older men, women, and children. You see that often. You can't reason with the younger SS at all, but the older ones who commit crimes on a grand scale are sometimes humane in minor things, like now, with you. I don't think that's a point in their favor, Hans said. On the contrary, the youngsters have been raised in the spirit of blood and soil. They don't know any better. But those older ones, like the Lagerarzt, show through those minor acts that they still harbor a remnant of their upbringing. They didn't learn this inhumanity from an early age and had no need to embrace it. That's why they're guiltier than the young Nazi sheep who have never known better. They talked for a while longer. Friedel told him about the injections with malarial blood and the high fevers the women suffered as a result of the artificially induced malaria. It was now easy to get into Block 10 and less dangerous to stay there. Large groups of Poles were being put on transports regularly, and that gave the Jews opportunities to occupy better positions. They could now work in the Bekleidungskammer and the photographic studio. There were even a few in the kitchen, and Jewish doctors were no longer limited by preference to the filthiest jobs, but actually did some real medical work. As a result, it was now possible for a Jew to go into Block 10 under the pretext of some job or other, whereas previously the Poles had kept such pleasant tasks to themselves. On the one hand, then, the Polish transports gave them a much more bearable life. On the other, it made them very anxious. The Poles were put on transports, as were the Russians. The Reich Germans, inasmuch as they weren't political prisoners, were incorporated into the SS. All this was clearly influenced by the German withdrawals and the constantly approaching front. Now, in the summer of 1944, the Russians had already reached Radom, midway between Lemberg and Krakow. That was only 125 miles from Auschwitz. The next offensive could reach the camp. What would happen to its inmates then? There were various opinions circulating, an evacuation of the camp, for one. That wouldn't be simple, because although its occupation rate was greatly reduced, the entire Auschwitz complex still held some 120,000 prisoners. Others were convinced the Germans would exterminate them all. There were very few optimists who believed they would let the witnesses to their outrages fall into Russian hands alive. They were living in a turmoil of growing tension. In July, a climax. The Führer is dead. Wehrmacht and SS are fighting each other everywhere. The generals have taken over the government. Never before had rumors like these done the rounds and been believed so firmly. But although it was even claimed the next day that the war was over and a new German government had begun negotiations with the Allies, the SS remained at their posts. Despite this, the rumors were closer to the truth than ever before. Days later, they read in an already outdated newspaper, which the non-Jews were allowed to subscribe to, how the von Witzleben affair had played out in reality. Footnote: Erwin von Witzleben, a German officer, was a lead conspirator in the failed plot to assassinate Hitler in 1944. He was tried and sentenced to death on August 7th by the Nazi People's Court, known as the Volksgerichtshof, which had jurisdiction over so-called political offenses. The rumors that circulated in the camp were always a caricature, an exaggeration of reality. But you could be sure that there was something going on, even though it was often difficult to discover the true scale of the facts. It was like that with Block 10, too. For half a year now, there had been constant talk of Block 10 being relocated. A new barracks complex had been built a couple hundred yards from the camp. The SS had moved in, and one building was supposedly for Block 10. Always that fear of their approaching separation. But nothing happened. Until, in August, the rumor took on more concrete form. Five of the new buildings were going to be women's blocks. Block 10 would be housed there along with the better female commandos, like those working in the SS laundry and the munitions factories. And suddenly, the day of the move arrived. For hours, the women stood lined up outside, counting, counting, and counting again. Nobody understood what they were waiting for, but Hans and Friedel were glad of it. There were hardly any SS around, and they could talk at length, longer than ever. This farewell turned into their longest and calmest conversation for a year. Hans wanted to know what would happen to them in the new block. "I think they'll just continue the experiments. This week they were working under high pressure in Block 10. Apparently nobody was allowed to go to the new block who's not on the Klauberg and Goebel list, and that means being injected at least once. The staff weren't exempt anymore either." "And you, how did you manage to get out of it?" Hans asked, terrified that she was about to admit what he had feared for so long. Never had they given up hope of coming through it all alive, and if Friedel had been gespritzt, she might be permanently infertile. She could tell how scared he was. "There were 34 nurses and other staff who hadn't been through it yet. We all had to come before Klauberg to explain why we hadn't had our turn yet and to hear when we had to come in for the test. Those who refused would be sent to Birkenau. When I was standing before him, I told him I was suffering from an inflammation of the renal pelvis. 'Yes,' he said, 'it's not possible at the moment then. That could be fatal.' Fortunately, nobody checked me, because I got over that inflammation a month ago." It was astonishing that she had said the one thing that hit the mark. She was a layman, but must have had wondrous intuition. Toward midday, the women marched off. Now they would no longer be able to see each other whenever they wanted to, but the men who worked in the new blocks could still deliver letters and packages. Friedel would try to come into the camp to see the dentist or the radiologist as often as she could, and that would allow them to still meet. Most of the men knew nothing about their wives at all. Some, like Ailey, knew that they were dead, but even those who knew their wives were in an adjoining camp, like Birkenau, for instance, had never had any opportunity to contact them. Hans and Friedel still had nothing to complain about. Roll call was over, and Hans and Ailey were walking along Birkenallee. It was still oppressively hot. Later it would be crowded here, but most of the Häftlinge were still in their blocks waiting for their bread. For the moment, there were only some prominents and Pfleger around. Sitting on a bench were Dr. Valentin and Professor Mansfeld. Valentin called out to Hans, "So, are you back to normal again now?" Hans hadn't realized he'd been acting abnormally. They sat down on the grass next to their older colleagues. "Being sad seems very normal to me," Hans said. "That face of yours the whole day long. What have you got to complain about? You'll be sure to find another opportunity to get in touch with your wife." "Yes, but nowhere near as easily. And if she gets into difficulties of any kind, I won't be able to help her." "What kind of difficulties could come up now?" the professor asked. "You'd be surprised, Prof," Ailey replied. "There's still a lot they're capable of. First of all, there are two X-ray rooms in that new block. They can work on an even larger scale than in Block 10. Or you might have heard of those new test experiments they're going to do. There's a row of small rooms in the new block that are apparently intended for bringing women together with men. Then you can see from the result whether or not the sterilization method was effective." Hans didn't believe it. "Come on now, there are so many stories. There's also constant talk of a Jewish brothel that's going to be opened on the 1st of September. Ailey thought the two rumors had to be based on something. Maybe the tests will be carried out in a kind of brothel. Then I hope there's not a single man who makes use of it." Professor Mansfeld joined the conversation. "Don't be ridiculous. If they take it into their heads to try something like that, you won't have any opportunity to dissuade them." "His wife hasn't even been injected. What is there to test?" Ailey said. "Ah, that doesn't mean much one way or the other," the professor continued. "You can't expect any logic from our overlords. Their experiments are neither logical nor systematic. They're just whims. Whatever pops into their head, they try it out. Last month, in a camp near Königshütte, An Oberscharführer locked three men and three women up with each other in a small room for several days. He took away all their clothes and observed their behavior closely. Then he stuffed one of the men with food, let another eat normally, and didn't give the third anything at all. He was trying to test the influence of nutrition on sexual performance. Even a child understands that something like that is too insane. Hans agreed. Exactly. That's just a personal whim. Take those tests with sedatives, for instance. Last week, an SS man came into Block 19 and picked out three men. They were given a powder dissolved in real coffee. Shortly afterward, they fell asleep. Two never woke up again. The third happened to come to after 36 hours. I can imagine how they hit on research like that. The gentleman from the SS was a little upset by the von Witzleben affair and couldn't get to sleep at night. In his home apothecary, he found some powders from Canada, but he was a bit timid about trying them. So why not a scientific experiment with a few Häftlinge? Ailey interrupted him. It's nonsense to even try to analyze an experiment like that. A waste of time. That experiment in Königshütte is nothing more than the perverse gratification of a man who wanted to observe those people's sex lives. Experiments like the ones in Block 10 are a different matter. Wrong, sir, the professor snapped. From a humanitarian and scientific perspective, none of the experiments carried out by Germans, in fact, all of German science since 1933 has been a hair better. A major factor, of course, has been the expulsion of all Jewish scholars. Throughout the history of German science, there have been remarkably large numbers of Jewish and foreign scholars. You find an especially large number of Poles among German scientists. People like Copernicus have been annexed in the propaganda to demonstrate German superiority. What if Hitler hadn't kicked out the Jews? German science still wouldn't have produced much. After all, science means investigate and conclude. In Germany, the conclusion is determined in advance. It has to agree with state dogma. As long as it's about purely technical discoveries, for the war industry or in the field of medicine, research results are happily accepted. But as soon as a German scholar ventures into historical or philosophical territory, he knows in advance which conclusion his research has to lead to. And if he's stupid enough to come up with a result that conflicts with National Socialist doctrine, he won't last long. I understand all of that perfectly, Professor. But getting back to our women, these are purely technical experiments here, so they can be carried out properly. Science is a system that has developed in service of human society. For that reason alone, research into mass sterilization can't be set up scientifically, because German science doesn't serve humanity, but the German race. In any case, look at the practice. Who is playing a role here? Klauberg, Goebel, people from the Gestapo, and Samuel, who's trying to save his own skin. The experiments are carried out by a Scharführer who doesn't have a clue and derives his authority from a former career as a toothbrush salesman. No, sir. Research that goes against every human principle has nothing to do with science. If one of my former lab assistants had treated a laboratory animal the way the women are treated here, I would have marched him to the door myself. Mansfeld's account made a great impression on them, but no sooner had he finished than the Block 9 messenger came up to them. They had to go straight back. They were moving to Block 8 that same evening. For a couple of hours, they had to work hard, dismantling cabinets and tables and packing medicaments. But fortunately, a countermand arrived, moving tomorrow. It was an arduous day's work, carrying patients, straw mattresses, and beds. Block 8 was a filthy, run-down quarantine block. Blocks 9 and 10 were going to be used for gypsies, entire families, men, women, and masses of children. They were privileged prisoners who, for unknown reasons, had escaped Birkenau and were being sent to camps in Germany. Generally, it was no different for the gypsies than for the Jews. They were a much smaller group than the Jews and had occupied a much less important social position in the various European countries, but in Birkenau they went up the chimney all the same. Yet more proof that the persecution of the Jews was not essentially an anti-capitalist struggle against the global Jewish plutocracy. Practiced in hate, the SS was an organ for the oppression of their own German people and related nations. They rehearsed their methods on the Jews, Russians, and Gypsies under the motto of racial purification. The camps of Ellecom in the Netherlands on the edge of the Veluwe and Stutthof near Danzig were officially considered SS training camps, Schulungslager. In the camps, the members of the SS were able to satisfy the sadistic tendencies that had been aroused in them, and because they were given these opportunities of satisfaction, they remained obedient followers of Hitler until the end. After a week, they had cleaned the block and done it up a little. The patients were covered with blankets that were still soiled from their predecessors. They were wearing undershirts that were disinfected once a month, but never washed, and therefore marked with brown bloodstains and spotted black with flea dirt. But at first sight, everything was clean. The floors were shining white, and the beds nicely painted. It had been an expensive week because they didn't get any official supplies and had to pay for the paint for the beds and doors with food, bread, and margarine that was, therefore, no longer available for the patients. Unfortunately, more gypsies arrived on the ninth day, and Block 8 moved to Block 7. There were now 2,000 gypsies in the camp, and it was a bigger mess than ever. After all, Auschwitz was a bad camp. A barbed wire fence was erected around the three gypsy blocks, and there were always two sentries on duty, but that didn't prevent a brisk trade from developing at the wire. The gypsies received more bread than the others and used it to buy sausage and potatoes, which were smuggled into the camp by the ordinary prisoners. This led to a devaluation of bread. Whereas a ration of bread was initially worth 12 potatoes, you could now only get 7 for it. The gypsies played music and danced all day, and the men at the fence feasted their eyes until the guards chased them off with blows or subjected them to punishments for loitering around the camp during work time. But things got even more out of hand after dark. Then men from the camp would find a way into the gypsy blocks, and a lot of the gypsy women would slip through the barbed wire fencing to fill their own stomachs properly for once and sweeten the lives of the Blockälteste and Kapos, who often had a room of their own in the work blocks. Although they could also get by without a room, as long as there was something to eat and drink. Raids in the middle of the night. The SS searching for women in all the beds in the whole camp. So many victims. Every morning the barbed wire needed to be repaired again. Hans didn't like the uproar. Seeing the gypsies enjoying themselves only made you more intensely aware of everything you were missing in the camp. It made you feel even more like someone who has been buried alive. He had little interest in the gypsy women. The time he used to spend outside Friedel's window talking to her, he now spent upstairs with fellow doctors or talking to Professor Freida, the Amsterdam professor of economics who had been a patient in the Krankenbau for a week now. The old man had arrived on the last Dutch transport. By chance, he'd got in the right line after getting off the train. In Auschwitz, he was put in the roadworks commando. After just a few weeks of dragging wagons all day, he hadn't been able to hold up any longer and had been admitted to hospital. He was soon very popular among the doctors because of his friendly, modest attitude. They found le professeur hollandais très charmant. But for Hans, he was a great worry. In the mornings, even before the gong, the men were already jostling at the windows of Block 7, which was opposite Block 8, to see the women washing themselves. Then the Blockältester came and chased the patients back into bed. But he didn't come into the Pflegestube, and the Pfleger amused themselves at length with erotic sign language conversations with gypsy women in various states of undress. In a situation where even St. Anthony would have succumbed to temptation, Hans did look across at the other block now and then, but only fleetingly, because seeing women only heightened his longing for Friedel. Maintaining communication hadn't been easy. Krebs, the Dutch dental technician, had already spent a few days in the bunker for passing on letters to the women. A letter from Hans had been among them. During his interrogation, Krebs had explained that it was a letter from a man to his own wife. There was nothing special in it. Krebs was one of the few Dutch prominents, and that was lucky for him, because with the help of his boss, the Obersturmführer of the dental clinic, the matter was soon settled. Friedel's hospital visit hadn't gone well either. She did come each Wednesday when the girls came to the Krankenbau for their consultations, but the SDG was always there. He was a dirty character, a Romanian. The foreign SS men were always even crueler than the Germans. He gave the girls a hard time, stood over them while they were being examined, and then often disappeared upstairs with one of them, taking her to one of the optician's or chemist's rooms. The lads would quickly seize the opportunity to talk to their wives. This time it was Hans, Meisel, and de Hond who had been let in for a moment by the second SDG. Friedel told him about the new block. There weren't any experiments there. The girls had been allocated to all kinds of commandos. She was on a night shift making clothes. It wasn't easy, 12 hours on the go in an attic, in the dust, sewing old rags, and if she didn't complete her quota, they hit her. She couldn't bear the dust and couldn't stop coughing. It wasn't long before the Romanian was back again. He'd been drinking and made some filthy remarks before chasing out all of the men. When would he see Friedel again? He had to think of something better. That was on Wednesday. On Thursday, all the gypsies left, and on Friday, they had to move again. They were going back to Block 9, which was now very much the worse for wear. The next morning, Achtung, Lagerarzt! He didn't go to the wards, where it was still a great mess, but headed straight to the Blockältester's room, where he spoke to the head doctor for a few minutes. After he was gone, Jelena called all of the doctors into outpatients. A list had to be made of all patients. Next to the names, the doctor had to fill in whether or not the patient could be discharged, and if not, how much longer he would have to stay in the hospital. 1, 2, 3 weeks, or longer than 3. Their expressions were dark because they realized that there was something nasty behind it, and the discussion grew heated as they tried to identify the limit, how long someone would be allowed to be sick without risking the gas chamber. Hans spent a long time talking to Fleschner, the French doctor who was treating Frieda, about the professor's fate. They couldn't say he was healthy. If they did, he would be discharged immediately, and at the moment he couldn't walk 100 yards. But they didn't dare say longer than 3 weeks either. That would seal his fate. To make matters worse, the Lagerarzt had taken all of the index cards with him, so simply making the professor disappear by hiding him was no longer an option. They called in Jelena and decided together to write down 3 weeks. There is no decision in his life that Hans regrets as much. The next day, the card index was returned, except the cards of the Jews who had to stay in the hospital for more than 2 weeks. These patients were to be picked up the next day to be put to work at the Birkenau weaving mill in a light commando. The Birkenau weaving mill was the world's biggest factory. Under this pretext, they had already taken a couple of million people to the gas chamber. Jelena gave Hans Sunday morning off. The capo of the roadworks commando was a friend of Lane Saunders's, and, thanks to Lane's recommendation and a packet of cigarettes contributed for this purpose by a Polish patient, willing to let Hans turn out with his detail. 30 men were working in the new female camp, and they smuggled Hans in with them. He wasn't the only guest. At least half of the Sunday commando was interested in the girls. The SS hadn't latched on to this trick yet, and as a result, they could walk around the female camp relatively undisturbed. As long as they always had a shovel or a few slabs with them to immediately set to work if an SS man or one of the female overseers was in the vicinity, the capo said. Various lads disappeared into one of the attics with their girlfriends, but Friedel wasn't interested in that kind of stolen love. They stood behind a door in her block and were able to talk undisturbed for a long time. Hans poured out his heart to her about Frida. "There's nothing you can do," Friedel comforted him. "In most cases where you don't give a patient the best medicine, nobody can blame you for it, although that's much more to be expected from you than making the right choice with a vicious trick like this." That was true, and Hans tried not to dwell on his feelings of self-reproach. The next day, the trucks came. Hans felt miserable. Off went Professor Frida, the former rector of the University of Amsterdam, a man who had once presented Queen Wilhelmina with an honorary degree. He shook hands with Hans and asked him to pass on his regards to his loved ones should he survive. "But, Professor, you will see them again yourself." What else was he supposed to say? He didn't have the courage to simply speak the truth. He had to go along with the lies about Birkenau. Then an SS man came up and hurried the professor onto the truck. Dressed in a grimy undershirt and wearing wooden sandals, one of Holland's best known and most highly regarded academics climbed up onto the back of the truck that would take him to the gas chamber. With the SS, you never knew where you were. You witnessed the grossest contradictions. In the morning, when thousands marched out five abreast in straight lines to face a day of blows, hunger, and murderously hard labor, the orchestra, made up of 50 prisoners, would be playing at the gate. Once the doctors had to compile lists of those who were eligible for supplementary nutrition. The day after the lists were handed in, all of the malnourished misfortunates were hauled off to the gas chamber. Jewish women, slave laborers, could be thrashed at will. But if an SS man felt the urge, he would just as likely take a Jewish girl. "And if you're not willing, I'll use force." If a prisoner was caught organizing a piece of bread, he would be caned. But the trade in gold and diamonds, and in the slaughterhouse, once 14 pigs in one go, went through the SS. In the autumn of 1943, a sabotage plot was discovered in Majdanek, the concentration camp near Lublin. The SS then decided to eliminate all 18,000 Jews in one day. An enormous right-angled trench was dug. The people undressed in one side of the right angle, then walked around the corner to be gunned down. The racket of the machine guns and the cries of the victims were drowned out by five orchestras. Lagerarzt Klein was an expert at selections. One evening, the entire camp population had to file naked past the Rapportführer in the old laundry. They got undressed outside on Birkenallee. Standing at the entrance were a few Blockältester who gave everyone a shove. Those who stumbled over the doorstep were Musulmen. Those who marched past the gentlemen with their chests puffed up were through. They picked out about 1,000 that way and then stuffed them in an empty block. In the night, all the non-Jews were released. The next day, the Jews filed past the Lagerarzt between blocks 8 and 9 while he checked whether there weren't perhaps some strong ones left amongst them. He was having an animated conversation with Hössler, the Lagerführer, and mostly had his back to the passing column. Now and then, he turned around and picked out someone at random, who was then saved for a while. In the camp at that time, two blocks, 22 and 23, were surrounded by barbed wire. Women were apparently going to be moved into them. In Block 23, they set up a small outpatients clinic. Friedel began looking worse and worse. She couldn't cope with the night shifts in the sewing workshop and was coughing more and more and regularly running a temperature. Hans decided to go to the Lagerarzt to ask if she could be sent to the new outpatients as a Pflegerin. Valentin, the head doctor of the upstairs wards, thought Hans had gone mad. The Lagerarzt would just smash him in the gob. He could kick him out of the hospital into a heavy commando for that kind of impudence. You weren't even allowed to know your wife was here, let alone speak to the Lagerarzt about it. But Hans was counting on the inconsistency, the split personality these SS officers displayed. And sure enough, the same man who had dispatched thousands to their deaths because they were sick or weak was happy for Friedel to be transferred from the sewing workshop to the outpatients in Block 23 because the dust in those old clothes was giving her such a terrible cough. After the mass selection that claimed Professor Freida, the Krankenbau was half empty. The Pfleger started to worry. If there's another selection like that, they'll get rid of a bunch of Pfleger at the same time. There's far too many. With danger approaching, there was a sudden need to be heroic. Whereas before nobody had thought of resistance, they now felt that they couldn't simply surrender. One evening, Klempfner, a Czech doctor from the upstairs ward, summoned Hans and Eli Polak to his room. "There's an organization in the camp. Naturally, I can't tell you any details, but in our block there are now 15 people willing to follow me. Will you join us?" "Of course," Eli said. "What have we got to lose?" "If something's about to happen, I'll send for one of you to come and receive instructions. Then it will all be clear." It never got that far. After about a week, the order came. Block 9 was being dissolved. The patients and Pfleger were moving to Block 19, another hospital block which was also half empty. Hans's ward would remain intact. Jelena was being kept on as head doctor. In Block 19, the block Ältester was Sepp Rittner, a gigantic fellow, a communist who'd already spent 8 years in camps, but always with sunny Viennese humor, Wiener Blut, that refused to be cooled by Prussian tyranny. Hans had known him since coming to Auschwitz, and they were close friends. Now the good life could begin. In Block 19, Hans rose and became a prominent. Ochodzki, the ward doctor, had been put on a transport, and Jelena, who had now taken on the treatment of the non-Jewish patients, left more or less everything to Hans. Now that he was treating patients, he didn't need to do the dirty work anymore, and as he was in much closer contact with them, he was also given much more from their packages. He went to visit Friedel every day to take her some of his treasures. After all, she was now back in a block in the same camp. Of course, it was dangerous. In just the first weeks, 2 men were shot dead while trying to talk to the women at the fence. On Sunday evening, it was an 18-year-old boy. He had discovered his sister, who he hadn't seen for half a year. But the greatest frauds always stay unpunished the longest. That was what Hans was counting on as he strolled through the gate to Block 23 every day, holding a sphygmomanometer or a bottle under one arm. Sometimes he was carrying scales with a fellow doctor. The more they caught the eye, the better. And if an SS guard asked any questions, they were doctors at work, on their way to the female outpatients. The only danger was the SDG. A Romanian Rotenführer, who knew all too well that Hans had absolutely no business being there. On one occasion, he did catch them, when Hans and Friedel were sitting down together to talk. He threatened them and kicked Hans out, but didn't take it any further. On a Sunday soon after New Year, Alfonso Colette came up to Hans. Colette was the new capo in disinfection. He was a Spaniard, one of the many loyalists who had fled Franco. In France, he had fallen into German hands, out of the fat and into the fire, and ended up in a concentration camp. Here in Auschwitz, he was the central figure in a small group of Spaniards and Rotspanier, Spanish Reds, who were Germans who had fought on the side of the government in the Spanish Civil War and been handed over to Hitler by Franco, then sent to concentration camps. "You coming to Block 23?" Colette asked. "What's your excuse?" "Nobody questions me. Anyway, tomorrow my lads are disinfecting Block 23. That's why I want to go there today to have a look at what needs to be done." Colette was friends with Sarah, the acting Blockältester, a Belgian. He and Hans set off after the midday soup and spent the whole afternoon at Block 23 in the Blockältester room, talking 19 to the dozen with the women and having a great time. Later they were joined by a capo from the kitchen block who was having a relationship with the Blockältester and arrived with a bottle of gin. The block clerk was at the fence as a lookout and would raise the alarm if an SS man was heading for the women's blocks. The men from the work details who wanted to look at the girls on their free Sunday afternoon had been driven off with blows, but it never occurred to the guards that anybody could be as brazen as Colette and Hans. Stealing half a million is safer than stealing half a guilder. Colette told them about the new Jewish Lagerältester. Since all of the Poles had been put on transports, and most of the Germans had been conscripted into the SS, almost everyone left in the camp was Jewish. As a result, they had even appointed a Jewish Lagerältester. But after 2 days, the man had gone mad. He had developed megalomania. He was lying on his bed in his room when Kaduk, the second Rapportführer, came in and ordered him to get up. But the Lagerältester said that he wouldn't dream of letting Kaduk order him around, and that he, as Lagerältester, was not the Rapportführer's errand boy. They had an enormous row, and the Lagerältester was now in the bunker. The women laughed heartily, because for someone in a concentration camp, it really is very funny to hear about a häftling, even the Lagerältester, behaving like that to the Rapportführer. Hans was better informed. "What happened isn't funny at all. Alfonso's story is the official version, the one the SS is putting about. In reality, the case is very different. Red Cross packages came for the camp, and the Germans needed a signature from a prisoner's representative as proof the packages had been distributed. The Lagerältester refused. Now he's in the bunker, and he definitely won't be getting out alive." The kitchen capo's gin proved stronger than the Lagerältester's sad fate, so their spirits weren't dampened too much. They only had 3 chairs for the 6 of them, but kept their behavior within the limits of decency, although the limits of decency were, of course, somewhat different here from how they had been at home. Friedel was too in love to talk very much, but Sarah dominated the conversation. She chattered away about the big group of men who had been in the block on New Year's Eve. They had bribed the Blockführer, who was on duty, with a bottle of gin. Hans had his own information about the resulting party, too. Not only had the Jews been able to get on to better work details recently, they were even in the orchestra. Jewish musicians had been brought into Auschwitz from all the nearby camps. They had formed a swing band amongst themselves. All Dutch, because the orchestra's best musicians were Dutch, and definitely when it came to jazz. There was Jack de Vries and Maurice van Kleef, Lex van Veren and Sally van der Kloot. Also Ab Frank, bandmaster of the Baumeister Review. Hans had played clarinet with them. He'd been there that New Year's Eve too, but had gone straight to Friedel's room. Sarah couldn't have known that, and there was no reason she should either. Half drunk, Sarah rattled away. Now about the sauna. The sauna was the large washroom with 200 showers. The commando that worked there was the most popular of all. You could see more naked women there than anywhere in the world, sometimes 1,000 at once. The men who worked there could be real swine. Some of them walked among the women and harassed them shamelessly. For half a packet of margarine, you could turn out with the commando for a day. If women from Birkenau were coming to wash that day, tough luck, because that was a nasty sight. All those worn-out, emaciated bodies, almost as dirty after washing as before. But if the women were from Auschwitz, from the better commandos, then... The most brazen were the SS, of course, who went there for their entertainment. They made the women do gymnastics for them and carried out inspections. A girl here in the block was already pregnant. Friedel and Hans were not as animated as the others. It was all great fun, an afternoon like that. But being so close to each other made the longing grow so much. The longing for freedom, for home, for children, for life. They were privileged, unique among the thousands here. But even the benefits were a poor substitute. Hans grew somber. He always got like that when he drank. Friedel tried to cheer him up, stroking his head and joking about his going bald. But he spoke of the future and the decision that was almost upon them. Yesterday's newspaper had reported for the first time on the Russian offensive. The Russians had mounted an attack, and the Germans needed to shorten the front to gain time for the necessary countermeasures to take effect. The decision couldn't be far away now. The front was only 90 miles from Auschwitz. The tension was rising. The tension kept rising. On Tuesday evening, the newspapers wrote about District Krakow. On Wednesday, the Krakauer Zeitung didn't arrive. There were more and more air raid alarms, more and more blackouts, undoubtedly caused by partisans. Sometimes in the night they could already hear the artillery, if dull and very distant. Wednesday evening, Hans and Ailey were working in the outpatients in Block 28. They were on duty there once a week. It was awful work. You only had a few pieces of paper and a bit of ointment to dress wounds. To get an aspirin for a patient, you had to work through a mountain of bureaucracy, and then mostly there turned out to be nothing available anyway. Unless the patient had cigarettes or margarine, then he could sort it out with the outpatient's Pfleger, who did have dressings and aspirin. He, in turn, bought them from the prisoners who worked in the SS infirmary, where the attics were full of inexhaustible supplies. Bandages, medicaments, toiletries, whatever you wanted. The prisoners got almost none of that through official channels. But Hans had something in his pocket, a roll of sticking plaster and some gauze. He either organized it at the Block 19 outpatients or bought it himself to dress the Dutch patient's wounds. He had bread to spare and couldn't take it all to Friedel. As a result, they were soon surrounded by Dutch patients. It was slow working by candlelight. Chaos had crept in. All over outpatients, small groups were engaged in intense discussion. The issue that was preoccupying them, evacuation, extermination, or surrendering to the Russians. None of them came to a conclusion. Everything was equally plausible. Later in the evening, some women came with a female patient who needed an operation. Dr. Alina Breuda was with them. For half a year, she had been the Blockältesta of Block 10, until she refused to cooperate with a particular experiment. She was Friedel's guardian angel, and as such, Hans knew her well. A female overseer and a Blockfuhrer had accompanied the women, but they couldn't escape the tension either and left them to their fate. Breuda came over to Hans and asked him what the men thought of it all. He didn't know. He was just glad the end was in sight. Breuda was in a dark mood. She had seen too much. She was from Warsaw, where 500,000 Jews had been squeezed into the ghetto, which had room for 150,000. From there, they were successively carted off. Once, in Treblinka, the SS killed 23,000 in a single day, probably their record, more even than the 18,000 in one day in Majdanek. The Warsaw Jews saw that there was no way out, and the uprising began. That was in April 1943. They got weapons from the Poles outside the ghetto and hid in the old buildings. the SS had great difficulty forcing their way through the streets, and when they finally had the ghetto in their hands, armed Jews were still concealed everywhere in the cellars and sewage canals that are so numerous in an old city. The entrances to the cellars were camouflaged. You slid a sink cabinet to one side or raised a rug. At night, they emerged and carried out bloodbaths among the SS occupiers. Unable to gain control over these underground forces, they were left with only one option. They mined all of the houses and blew them up. "Only a few thousand escaped," said Broda, "like me." Later, they all fell into the hands of the SS again. The uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto was a case study of a people's war. It was doomed to failure. A 500,000 badly armed Jews couldn't win the war against Hitler. There are still hundreds of thousands buried under the rubble, but they dragged more than 20,000 SS troops into the grave with them. When a child starts to cry, the mother wakes from the deepest sleep. Even if the sensory contact with the outside world has been broken in sleep, the mind remains alert, especially if we're expecting something. At 3 a.m, the gong began to sound, and within a few seconds, the whole camp was in an uproar. Hans dressed quickly. When he got outside, he saw men streaming out of all of the blocks and lining up as if for roll call. Evacuation, after all. It was bitterly cold and fine snow was drifting down, but nobody seemed to feel it. Everyone was too excited because the end was approaching. Whatever happened, Auschwitz was finished. Blocks 23 and 24 were still completely dark. Hans went back into the Krankenbau to ask Sepp what they had to do. "Nothing," Sepp said. "There aren't any instructions yet for the sick. And anyway, we don't have any clothes for them. I'm not letting them go like this." Sepp was right, and Hans urged people to stay calm. But almost everyone had got out of bed, and many of them were walking around the camp, looking for friends they wanted to say goodbye to. 30 minutes after the gong, there was a roll call. The numbers weren't right anywhere. But what could they do? The roll call was abandoned, and the men had to form up in their commandos like every other morning. At 5, the first groups left. They were made up of non-vital commandos like roadworks and river gravel. The factory and food production commandos were going to stay. Even as they were marching off, rumors arose that, as always, were a clear reflection of people's hopes. "Half are going on transport now. The rest will stay and carry on working. The machines will all be carted off, and we'll stay until the Russians get here." Long lines of farmers' wagons were driven into the camp. They loaded up bread and preserves from the kitchen storerooms and then set off after the transports that had left. Meanwhile, the lights had gone on in Block 23. Hans went around to the back. Nobody was watching out to see if anybody was standing by the barbed wire. But how to catch their attention? He whistled all kinds of tunes. Then he tried the Belgian national anthem, La Brabançon. That worked. Sarah opened her window. Yes, she would call Friedel. "Friedel, stay as long as you can." "Sweetheart, no. That's much too dangerous." "Listen to me." They disagreed. Then Friedel had to go. She needed to arrange clothes. Later, when it was light, Hans would try to get into the block. He walked back past the long lines of those who were leaving. They were shivering from the cold, as they had already been standing outside for a couple of hours and had almost no clothes on. Those few linen rags offered no protection. Some of them had wrapped themselves in blankets, but many hadn't dared. As if keeping the camp intact made any difference now it was being abandoned. The Pfleger were lined up in Block 19. Sepp had received his instructions. Clothes for the patients were going to be issued in the Bekleidungskammer, and they had to go there with the stretchers to pick them up. At 8 o'clock, the designated commandos left. It was now light, and Hans was heading back to Block 23 when he bumped into the Rotenführer, who was looking for Pfleger for a job in the women's block. His only option was to lay his cards on the table, asking if he could go with them to say goodbye to his wife. The Romanian grinned. Friedel was overjoyed to see him. A transport of women had already left, and they had searched for her everywhere, but she had hidden in the attic because she still wanted to say goodbye to him. He had only been there a moment when the Rotenführer had someone call him. The Dutchman had to come immediately. There was a coke oven in the attic that needed to be taken to the laundry. Hans swore, but didn't dare object, and got the oven from the attic. It was an enormous weight, but when Hans was angry, that was something he liked. He carried the oven to the laundry in one go and threw it down on the floor. He was standing there catching his breath for a moment when he saw the Rotenführer arriving with the other lads who weren't carrying anything at all. He'd only made Hans carry it so he couldn't stay there with his wife. That Rotenführer was the bane of his life, but now he'd outsmart him. The Rotenführer went into the Schreibstube with the lads to get all of the paperwork, which had to be burnt. In the meantime, Hans disappeared. Back with Friedel, he was at a loss for words. "Do you really not want to try to stay?"
"No, they'll finish off everyone who's sick. But that journey will be terrible. Are we up to that?" "We don't have any choice, Hans. Promise me you'll go too."
He hesitated. Then he promised. But at the same time, he felt that he was being dishonest with her for the first time, because he was scared to death of that journey. In the same instant, the door opened. It was Colette. "I told Sarah she had to stay, but she's too scared." Hans said he didn't understand the women, but there wasn't anything they could do about it. Then yelling sounded through the block. "All line up!" The farewell was brief. Friedel was scared of looking weak. As always, she couldn't face the feelings that assailed her. Hans turned at the door, but she raised her hands as if begging him to leave and not make it even more difficult. The rest of the day was uneventful, and Hans felt numbed. For 2 years they had fought together. They'd had many close calls, but they had never let themselves be parted for long. First at the train, the selection. Then the frightening month he'd spent in Birkenau, and later after Block 10 had been moved. They had always found each other again. But now? The next morning, the capo from the kitchen block came with a letter from Friedel. "Hans, I've been in the women's camp since yesterday. I think you were right. It would be better to stay. That's what everyone here wants, but it won't be possible. If only Sarah hadn't been so stupid. They just cleared the block next to ours, beating the girls out with their rifle butts. Anyway, I'll do my best, darling. Be brave. One day we'll see each other again. They're already on their way. Bye, sweetheart." He read and reread it. What did she mean, if only Sarah hadn't been so stupid? He went to see Colette. "Yesterday I took 3 sets of men's clothing to Block 23, for Friedel and the 2 Sarahs, but my Sarah was too scared." Hans could have kicked himself. That would have been the solution. Dress them in men's clothing, then do or die together. "What are you going to do now, Alfonso?"
"We're not leaving, not under any circumstances. You'll see that the rest of the camp will leave today, except maybe the sick, but we're going to hide. We don't want to die in the snow on the side of the road."
"Where are you going to hide?" Hans asked.
"If you keep your mouth shut, I'll show you."
Under the enormous pile of dirty clothes in the disinfection cellar, they'd made a concealed hiding place. The cellar was concrete, and the building above it was made of wood, so even if it collapsed, they'd still be safe. Alfonso turned out to be well informed.
Around 11 o'clock, the Lagereltester ran through the camp like a madman. All turn out! Even the kitchen staff left. The Krankenbau was the only place nothing happened. There were virtually no SS left. They had gone on the marches with the transports, and their departure signaled the start of the plundering of the camp. They fetched clothes from the Bekleidungskammer and tore open the bags in the Effektenkammer, with everyone picking out the best things they could find. The storerooms under the kitchen had been broken open, and the patients, who had hardly been able to drag themselves that far, were now sitting down to stuff themselves from tins of meat and barrels of sauerkraut. And what was worse, they'd found vodka in a cellar, Polish vodka that was almost pure alcohol, burning your throat and without the slightest taste. Late in the afternoon, the first victims, ill, critically ill, vomiting and diarrhea, deeply miserable, with others rolling over the street or lying stupefied in the gutter, so terribly drunk. The start of an eventful evening. At 8 o'clock, the Rotenführer appeared with a few henchmen. Everybody who could walk had to get ready. Almost all of them wanted to go. Only the Poles were willing to stay. They all said they were too sick for a transport, evidently pinning their hopes on the partisans. There were endless discussions about who was in the best condition. A couple of doctors had to stay in each block. In Block 19, it was Ackermann, a non-Jewish Dutchman, and Hans, who preferred the dangers of the camp to those of the transport. Hans was counting on Colette with his Spaniards. At 10, the Rotenführer bellowed that everyone had to come outside. Then came Sepp's miraculous deed. He locked the door on the inside, took up position in front of it with his feet planted firmly, and snarled at anyone who tried to get out. You idiot! With your sick body out in the cold, where do you think you'll end up? If the Romanian comes to get you, it will be soon enough. But the Romanian didn't come to get them. He only had a few men with him and wasn't equal to the situation. Fully armed, wearing a helmet, with a rifle on his back and a torch in his hand, he still felt unsure of himself now that his cushy life was over, too. He didn't even notice that nobody from Block 19 had turned out. Sepp's moment of boldness had saved hundreds of lives. Once the Krankenbau had marched off, it was very empty in the camp. There were only a few hundred bedridden patients who hadn't been able to leave the three hospital blocks, plus the overcrowded Block 19, full of patients and a wide range of other camp inmates who had gone to Sepp's block to lay low. Late that night, maybe around 11, there was an incident. Ackermann had gone out to the kitchen block with a few men to get some food. An SS man was standing in the front square. He must have thought they were looters and opened fire without warning. Ackermann was shot in the stomach. An hour later, he was dead. When Hans heard what had happened, he realized the camp could burst into turmoil at any moment. The time to act had come. He went to disinfection. The Spaniards were in the middle of a heated discussion. Some of them were in favor of hiding in the cellar. Others, Colette among them, preferred to flee. They had found a submachine gun in one of the warehouses, and if they encountered small groups of SS along the way, they would defend themselves. They decided that Hans and Colette would scout out the situation. In Block 15, which had a view of the gate, the lights were on. It was the fire commando who had been ordered to stay behind. They had dragged a piano out of the concert hall, and it was sheer pandemonium. It was like a little boy who is afraid of the dark and hides his fear by singing at the top of his voice. They admitted that their situation was precarious, but didn't have any new information. The Russians hadn't even entered Krakow yet. Anything could happen before they reached Auschwitz. When Hans and Alfonso went outside, they heard voices near the gate. It was German, some incomprehensible dialect. They crept past the kitchen block, and then, looking around the corner with a small mirror, saw that it was two Wehrmacht soldiers, old men on sentry duty. They slipped back to Block 15, then simply walked down the road to the gate.
"Good evening," said the soldiers.
"Good evening. Are you on sentry duty?"
"Yes, our company's stationed in a building close by."
One of the soldiers wanted to buy Alfonso's watch for some bacon. Alfonso began haggling with him in the hope of finding out more, but a car suddenly drove up. They tried to leave, but it was too late. The man in the car called them back. It was